Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello, and welcome to the Ghibliotech, the podcast that ventures into the vault of films from the world's greatest animation studio, Studio Ghibli. I'm Michael Leader, and I've seen the lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm trying so, so hard to catch up.
So join us on our quest into the glorious world of Ghibli. So Jake, here we are again.
We're back. Six
episodes over the summer, we're going to delve deeper. How's your education going? What films have we seen so far?
Well, I feel like I've maybe done my foundation course, and now I've got kind of a base knowledge. You've managed to enrich my world in so many ways, Michael. Perhaps beyond even the realm of Studio Ghibli, but I've learned a lot from you. I've learned a lot about these films. I've really enjoyed a lot of them. There's some that I've enjoyed more than others. But it's safe to say my eyes have been opened and I'm ready to explore.
Yeah. If this is your first episode of Ghibliotech, we've previously covered Princess Mononoke, Spirited Away, My Neighbor Totoro, Grave of the Fireflies, Only Yesterday.
Whisper of the Heart. Come on, your
Whisper
favorite.
Whisper of the Heart, my favorite. Oh God, how could I forgive myself? And if by way of reintroducing ourselves, I'm Michael Leader. I work for Film 4 in my day job, which is sort of the television home of Studio Ghibli here in the UK. And Jake, one day over the desk we were talking, found out that you hadn't seen any of these films.
No, I hadn't. So I produce a podcast for Curzon Cinemas here in the UK, and I work on short films for Channel 4 as well. And I had this enormous blind spot for these wonderful animated films. And the look on your face when I said that I'd never seen any of them, I'll never forget it.
And I'll never forget it either. But we're well on our way to getting you, kicking you into shape. And today, we're going to cover another Hayao Miyazaki film. It's Howl's Moving Castle. So to start with, a plot synopsis for Howl's Moving Castle. In a war-torn fantasy world, a young hatmaker named Sophie is cursed by the Witch of the Waste and turned into an old woman. Old Sophie soon becomes the cook and cleaner for a reclusive and moody wizard called Howl, who lives in a giant moving castle with his young assistant Markle and a fire demon called Calcifer. Reluctant to pick sides in the ongoing war, Howl adopts multiple disguises in public, but soon the devastation comes to the castle's doorstep. And as Howl plunges deep into darkness, it is up to Sophie to bring him back into the light.
So we will later on get into my thoughts on seeing this film for the first time. But as we have done on all our episodes, it's time for a history lesson. This is my favourite section of the show where I get to kick back and feel what it would be like if Michael was a lecturer to me for some time, which would be a wonderful thing. Tell me about Howl's Moving Castle.
Settle in, Jake. Get comfortable. Well, this is an interesting one because you have now seen the two films preceding this. You've seen Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away. And in both those episodes, we talked about how these were films that almost enlarged Ghibli's standing on a global scale. And this is where it really pays off. So in 2001, Spirited Away comes out and is a massive hit in Japan. It's still the highest grossing film of all time there. And Hayao Miyazaki immediately announces he's going to retire from feature filmmaking. Meanwhile, 2nd of September 2001, Ghibli announced they're going to make Howl's Moving Castle, an adaptation of a young adult novel from the 1980s by Diana Wynne Jones. And it's going to be directed, for the first time they announce, by an outsider, somebody who has no back history working for Studio Ghibli, and that guy is Mamoru Hosoda, who at that point had only had one feature film credit as director, which is Digimon the Movie, which is an interesting concept, someone coming in from outside to direct a big movie.
But I've heard that Digimon movie is very good.
I was always a Pokemon guy, I'm afraid.
Right, okay.
Sorry, so Digimon, don't even talk to me about Digimon. But less than a year later, they issue another press release saying that Mamoru Hosoda is off the project. Miyazaki's coming out of retirement and he's taken over. Mm. So really interesting one. I remember Mamoru Hosoda then go and have quite a really good career as a director in his own right. He immediately went and made a film called The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, a sort of young adult romance time travel sci-fi film. And I remember when that film came out over here, it would always have a sticker on in HMV saying, from the makers of Howl's Moving Castle, from the makers of Spirited Away. It was always confusing. Like, what do you mean by this? It's clearly not Studio Ghibli. And it's because he was originally slated to direct.
Right.
But it's only been very recently that he's been talking about what happened.
Was it an amicable split?
Well, I've got some quotes here. He recently did an interview. He's got a new film out that's in UK cinemas right now, as of November 2018, called Mirai of the Future,
yes,
which is a historic anime film because it was the first film to have its world premiere in Cannes, the Cannes Film Festival. But he's had an amazing career where he made Summer Wars, Wolf Children, The Boy and the Beast, and now Mirai. But back in 2002, he was out of a job. And here's what he says in an interview with Polygon recently. I was really excited, but with Ghibli, there's a certain tone and rules we had to follow. I was told to make the movie similar to how Miyazaki would have made it, but I wanted to make my own film the way I wanted to make it. The difference between the film I wanted to do and how they wanted to do it was too great, so I had to get off the project. And reflecting on the experience, he said, if I had to make Howl's the way Ghibli wanted me to make it, I think my career would have been over.
Wow.
When I got off the project, people thought, oh, he failed, he's over. But it was a good thing. I went on to do my own thing instead of making it the way Miyazaki would have made it. And he has had this amazing career. For a long time, he was labelled as the next Miyazaki, sort of struggling from under Miyazaki's shadow. And now he is one of the three or four big names in anime feature filmmaking in Japan.
Yeah.
Which is Hosoda. That's a whole other trail.
Yeah, I mean, once we do run out of Ghibli films, maybe that's the spin-off series we can do.
The spin-off series, indeed. But let's get back to Howl's Moving Castle as Hayao Miyazaki would make it.
Mm.
So this is a period where we've talked in the past about how Miyazaki has quite idealistic feelings behind his films, ambitions. He wants to inspire the youth. Whisper of the Heart, we talked about, where he wanted to give kids something to aspire to, a film that spoke to them on their level. And the mood he's in, circa 2001, 2, 3, 4, is very gloomy in this post-9/11 Iraq war sort of international landscape. He's very gloomy. And there's a negative worldview that sort of seeps into this film. Mm. I found a contemporary interview with Zam Brooks from The Guardian where he talks about his feelings and he says, personally, I'm very pessimistic. This is Miyazaki.
Yeah.
When, for instance, one of my staff has a baby, you can't help but bless them for a good future because I can't tell that child, oh, you shouldn't have come into this world.
It's amazing how this trajectory from Totoro to Whisper to Princess Mononoke to Spirited Away to this, it's amazing how much he has almost done a Benjamin Button and just ended up as an emo teenager.
Or a very, very grumpy old man. There are the GIFs out there of him doing interviews or from documentaries where he's saying, oh, anime is a mistake, I've wasted my life. Yet he can't retire.
Right.
Other quotes where he says about what he was going for with this film. With these conflicting thoughts in mind, I think about what kind of films I should be making. And if as artists we try to tap into the soul level, if we say that life is worth living and the world is worth living in, then something good might come out of it. Maybe that's what these films are doing. They're my way of blessing that child, blessing the child that he secretly thinks shouldn't have come into this world, which is a wonderfully conflicted way to further the greatest animated filmmaker of his lifetime, of all time, arguably. Anyway, that's where he was. House Moving Castle comes out. It has its world premiere at the Venice Film Festival, so continues this feeling that Ghibli is something on the world festival scale.
Yes, and this Spirited Away was Berlin, and we're covering Venice as well.
Exactly. Then released in Japan later that year, where it's a huge box office hit. Makes $190 million in Japan on release, sells 2 million units when it's released in home video. It didn't quite hit the highs of Spirited Away, but then nothing does. But House Moving Castle is still in the sixth position at the all-time box office in Japan, which is no mean feat. Behind Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, that recurring character in our podcast chat. But then on the international scale, this is another notch where Disney are fully behind it.
Yes.
After Spirited Away, this time John Lasseter is back as the hype man for Ghibli in America. He assigns Pete Docter, who by that point had co-directed Monsters, Inc., would go on to make Inside Out and Up. He handled the English language dub, which I think arguably the cast they have here is incredible.
Mm.
There's a story I know you like.
Yeah, well, that Christian Bale saw Spirited Away and loved it so much that he immediately got in touch and said, I want to do a voice on whatever the next film is.
So he's Howl.
Yeah.
But they also have Gene Simmons, great Hollywood actress, Lauren Bacall as the Witch of the Waste, Billy Crystal as Calcifer in probably the most Disney casting you could have, you know. When it's released, it does pretty well for a Ghibli film. It's nominated for the Best Animated Feature Oscar in a really good year. It's the only traditionally animated film in the category that year. In fact, it's up against two stop-motion animated films, Curse of the Were-Rabbit, the Wallace and Gromit movie, and then Tim Burton's Corpse Bride, and it loses to Curse of the Were-Rabbit. And then it's released internationally. Reviews are interesting, lots broadly positive as usual, but there are some mixed responses in there. The one that I've picked out here is from Roger Ebert, who for years beforehand was a champion of Miyazaki. He gives it 2.5 stars out of 4. He used to rate on a 4-star system and with half stars, which makes things nice and complicated. But he says he couldn't possibly recommend it as a film. While it's always wonderful to watch, it's a disappointment compared to his recent work. We grow impatient at spectacle without meaning, which is maybe something for us to come back to talk about.
Yeah, definitely.
And to bring it all full circle, 2005, September, October maybe, certainly the autumn, winter term of university. I see it my first year at Birmingham at the UGC Cinema, that's no longer called the UGC Cinema, it's a Cineworld now, on Broad Street in Birmingham. I go down and see it in the English language version.
And you were disappointed.
I was disappointed, mainly because of Billy Crystal, but we can get to this. But that's the context, Jake.
Brilliant.
That's all the history leading us up to House Moving Castle, and more importantly, leading us up to you watching it in 2018.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable, too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
So, Jake, this is the third of the 1-2-3 punch of Mononoke, Spirited Away, Howl's Moving Castle, these big international hits for Ghibli. What were your expectations for it?
Well, this is one of the last big ones off of the checklist, I think. We are doing our due diligence and balancing our series out for Every Spirited Way. There's an Only Yesterday as well. and I think this is like one of the last at that true top end of the spectrum of international popularity. Mm-hmm. And so I was aware of this film. We've spoken about iconography and like images existing outside of the realm of these films and into expanded pop culture, which we will get into later. And there was stuff that I recognised from this, like Calcifer's tongue and the images of the castle itself. And those, I think it was influenced by a lot of works, and it subsequently influenced a lot of works. And so there's a film coming up produced by Peter Jackson called Mortal Engines, which is about these enormous kind of ramshackle moving cities that charge across the earth. And to me, they just looked like what I had seen of the images of Howl's Moving Castle. And it had this, around 2006, there was that kind of post-grungy, early emo Panic at the Disco type craze, which I was a teenager within that realm. And Howl's was a big part of that culture as well. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of my friends covered their laptops in stickers of Howl's Moving Castle and things like that. And I'd never seen it, as we know, with this podcast wouldn't exist if I had. And so that was my expectation. This is a bit on the emo side of things. Mm-hmm. And it's less of the freewheeling Totoro type stuff that I was imagining. And then it all kicks off and we're into this magical world. Mm-hmm. That's something that I really love about the fantasy worlds, of not going straight in with a kind of wide-eyed Harry Potter walking down Diagon Alley for the first time, throwing all of the imagination of the world and the ideas of the animators at you all at once. Mm-hmm. It's kind of drip-feeding elements of this world. And it reminded me of one of my absolute favourite books, which is Northern Lights, part of the His Dark Materials trilogy from Philip Pullman, and how some of the world you just accept is different to our own.
Mm-hmm.
And then gradually you'll realise that, oh, that there are witches in this world. And it's just accepted because they are dropped in quite matter-of-factly. And the way that this film deals with magic, I think, is really interesting. A young boy suddenly has a hood and cape that he can wrap around himself and pull on a drawstring and he grows a beard.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone believes he's an old man. And I really love that. And it's interesting what you mentioned about Hosoda, the director of Mirai.
Mm.
And his introduction and exit to this film reminded me of Chris White's and Golden Compass.
Yes.
Of being kind of brought in, not a big name at the time, to handle the adaptation of something really big, young adult, fantasy, magical, almost medieval Victorian setting. And White has that same thing. And he ultimately leaves the project and then comes back and finishes it. And everyone knows that it didn't go very well. But he said after a year when he left, like, that I couldn't deal with it. Like, the amount of that people were getting involved and there was a identity that this film had to have. And he was suddenly jumping up to a $160 million budget that he'd never had before. And I just can't make this film.
It's so interesting you're mentioning these YA fantasy films, because Ghibli is so often talked about in its own context and often devoid of outside context, even within anime circles. But landing in 2004, 2005, as this did, it's right in the middle of that time where many of the studios were trying to find their Lord of the Rings, find their Harry Potter. Yes. You had the Narnia films. You had the attempt at making Northern Lights film.
Yep, Percy Jackson.
Stardust. You have so many films around that time. And this does dial into that. It's a very British, I mean, it's adapted from a British English language novel, but it does have that texture to it.
And well, you've mentioned this to me, how much he loves Europe. And
Miyazaki does. And this might be actually your first film that shows that.
Yeah, and you've spoken to me about it. And I know there are a few films that will tick this box. And this is the first time I've had that real crossover of culture.
It's where this fantasy world, we see maybe three or four different areas of it. Some look like maybe, I don't know, 18th century Denmark. One area is very explicitly meant to be Wales. It's this sort of mishmash with elements of steampunk, but then also high fantasy magic and so on. It's quite a gumbo to get to grips with.
Yeah.
And it's quite a world to grapple with. This is very full on as a film. Mm. And then once the plot gets going, it's even more full on.
Yes, you really get dunked into this, don't you? Mm-hmm. And I think we're split down the middle on our agreements of the two halves of this film. Mm-hmm. And this one really took me a while to get into because I think it's very exposition heavy at the start. And setting up who our hero is, a curse that befells, who does that curse,
the basic relationships between all the characters.
Yeah, and that you've got the main focus of the film is on a small selection of characters, but there's also a whole war going on in the background, of which we need to learn all the details of at the start as well. And it does get a bit messy. But I was also quite into just the workings of the world. Mm. That when Sophie gets work in Hal's castle, there is this doorway that, depending on which side of a twister wheel you end up on, which door you, or how, when you open the door, which world you end up in. And little bits like that I really loved. But I got a bit lost and noticed as I was watching it that I didn't actually fully know what was going on beyond the characters that we are given in Hal's kitchen. And those are the ones that I really want to focus on.
You know, I think I might have mentioned this on a previous episode, but there is a certain point in Miyazaki's filmmaking where it feels that he's just less interested in making laser-focused films.
Mm.
Totoro is the one I think I said before, which is almost every minute is, you know, meaningful.
Mm.
And you know exactly what to feel, where it's going, the flow of the film, etc. Princess Mononoke is a complicated, complex film, but you're there every second of the way. It never really, for me, it is overburdened by its ideas and its complicated character relationships. Howl's Moving Castle, I think, is one where Miyazaki lets it run away from him a little bit. But let's get back to maybe some of these key central characters, locales and so on.
Yes.
The moving castle itself. That's something that when Miyazaki read the book, what intrigued him most was, what is this castle? How does it move? How does it actually look? And you can really tell that he focused so much on the mechanics of a sort of a building with a face that's on chicken legs that will move.
Yes. And it moves so well. It moves with a kind of feeling of an old elephant on stilts.
Right.
It's got it manages to be completely metal and robotic, but also human at the same time.
Yeah.
And it becomes an extension of Hal.
Mm.
And when Sophie becomes part of Hal's castle, what's great is that she enters at the kitchen.
Mm.
And I think when you're presented with a story of high fantasy and princes and queens and things like that, you're so often used to those stories being told in the high chambers.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that the focus of the castle and most of the events that happen within the castle all happen in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's through these characters that are working and cleaning and cooking that the most important events in the story that we're being told in this world happened.
And that's a connection with Spirited Away. That's how Chihiro is introduced into this world. It's such an interesting connection between those two films. But then Howl himself is such a fascinating character as a mad bonkers wizard from a fantasy novel. He certainly doesn't look like a Gandalf or a Dumbledore.
No, he's very much a sexy flying David Bowie.
But also an emo David Bowie. He will be upset if his hair dye is misplaced and he comes out as a ginger, which as a ginger myself, I found quite offensive.
Yeah, and it's interesting that Howl is the title, or is the...
The castle is the title.
Yeah, the castle is the title, but Howl is referenced there when Sophie's really the lead.
Mm-hmm.
But Howl's an interesting one. He's got some odd characteristics that, in fact, a few characters have that seem to reference Spirited Away, or at least bring some of their design over. And I wonder if that was maybe some people at Ghibli thinking, well, Spirited Away was hugely successful and big internationally. Should we just make sure that there's some stuff that people know has the same DNA?
Mm-hmm.
And Howl is a bit of an emo boyfriend.
Exactly.
And it's a bit odd that Sophie kind of just lives for him a bit.
Well, it's something that watching these films again, maybe a decade and a half almost after I first saw it, something that strikes me is after making a few films early in his career, Miyazaki, where these female characters are fully, it's their own story, their own lives, taking control of their own lives, finding their own identity and their own craft, in the case of Whisper of the Heart. We'll come to Kiki's Delivery Service, which is another film that does that. Both Spirited Away and Howl's Moving Castle lumbers its main character with a very emotionally draining character, where they have to do, it's a term that is bandied around a lot now, emotional labour for him. Mm. There are moments where he goes into the depths of depression, and it's just depicted as him going into a sort of brace crouch, and this gloopy green substance covers him that when you touch him sticks to you, and it's it's only a momentary depiction, but it's clearly getting at something about depression and having to handle that as one of the family and friends around it. Yeah. But it's strange that Sophie has to handle that herself, as opposed to, and then as the film goes on, she needs to figure out what's wrong. What is the bargain he made with Calcifer to set, that gave him power, but also took away his soul or his heart. She has to figure that out, as opposed to figuring out her own problems. She has issues with self-image. She says she's never been beautiful, and now she's cursed with looking like a 90-year-old woman. It's not so much her finding her own authority anymore as helping another man. And I don't know, that's something that maybe didn't sit well with me watching it as an older person. Mm. But some things that do resonate with me now watching these films, and I wonder if they resonate with you now you've seen a few of them. This film solidifies so much of what is great about Miyazaki as a visual filmmaker, as an imaginative filmmaker. These threads where characters are defined by disguise or transformations or surprising turns. Mm. You mentioned Markle, who's the young boy who is Howl's
sadly
assistant.
Renamed from Michael
in the original. In the book, he's Michael, but that's what a ridiculous name to have in a Japanese movie. So he's called Markle. He has that incredible disguise as an old man. Of course, you then have Howl, who dons various disguises, at least names and identities throughout the film. But then you have Sophie.
Yeah, like one of them is Pendragon, which very much is in that old English.
And the Great Wizard Jenkins as well. Or Sophie herself, when she's cursed with looking like an old woman, as she goes through the film, as she receives love and attention, she has a moment of great bravery or courage, she turns back into a more youthful character, almost within the same frame.
Yeah, and we're in that realm that Spirited Away is doing, but maybe in Spirited Away, that idea of identity is attributed to one's name, that Chihiro becomes Sen, and then it ultimately, through that, the process of the film and doing the work that she needs to do, eventually is able to reclaim herself and understand herself. And that's the journey that we go on through these transformations and disguises, that someone like Howl, who in the earlier scenes is this labyrinth Bowie-like character who's got this wonderful, wonderful cape and earrings and dyed hair and looks fantastic. And immediately, as audiences, we are completely enamoured with him as well. He's brilliant. But we have to ultimately strip that back. And that's what all the characters will go through. One of the most interesting ones, I think, is the Witch of the Waste, who I found is a fascinating character. She's the one that curses Sophie at the beginning, this enormous woman all dressed in black, who at one point we see her being carried in a cart, and in the window is almost her entire face. Yes, it's that big. And over the course of the film, well, actually not really over the course of it, almost at the halfway point, she becomes just an old lady and becomes a friend of the main character. And someone who we're presented as a villain is not even defeated or anything like that. The idea of them being a villain is just removed from the table whatsoever.
Well, they remove her power, don't they? And you find that she's been using considerable magic to keep herself youthful. So she's turned into this kind of almost eviscerated old lady. But that gets to the heart of something else about Miyazaki, the sense of his reluctance or lack of interest in creating villains, antagonistic relationships, moral landscapes of good and evil. And that's something for me in the second half of the film, when it's about Howl's position within this war, but then the real battleground is within himself, that it starts to become a bit muddled. It's something that Roger Ebert in his review refers to as well. What you say, you
I
like
really
it
like
as it
the
goes
second
on?
Half, but I think that's maybe because I am far more accepting of the moments. The comparison film for me for this, from what we've seen already, is Princess Mononoke, which I think is going for a lot of plot and doesn't completely fit together. And I know that's probably our most most controversial opinion, judging by the tweets, was my opinion on Princess Mononoke, which didn't hang together at all. And I just got a bit bored with it because I genuinely lost track of about five different factions all telling me where their fights are going on and the screen geography not making sense to me. And the best moments of that film are the bits where the narrative falls away. Mm. And it's just the deer gods kind of memorial or transformation. And that's just sat in the realm of visuals and audio kind of transcending everything else that's going on.
And in Howls? What are the moments for you there?
Well, in Howls, it's when it slips. Again, all the nonsense of the war and the different towns and where everyone is slips away. And it's moments where Hal and Sophie are in a flower field.
Yeah.
And it's just two people who really like each other standing on a wonderful grassy bank with a perfect blue sky.
You love those blue skies green grass, don't you?
And it just chills out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the rhythm of the second half is a lot slower.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really happy to be in that world because it was almost telling me to ignore everything that had set up beforehand, as if that first half of exposition was an obligation to get audiences in the room to present them with this young adult steampunk story so that your reward is this more meditative second half.
Yeah, and having read those quotes from Miyazaki earlier where he says that it's the world is awful, you shouldn't be born, but if you are born, you might as well live life to the full or love yourself or whatever. You can kind of see that. The world is awful around you, therefore you might as well stand in a field with some laundry blowing on a washing line.
I mean, I'd do that with you any day.
Let's do it. But something I do like about this film, I feel like I'm quite down on it, but this film for me is almost the pinnacle of what I would call jukebox Miyazaki, where everything everyone expects. Whenever The Simpsons or Bob's Burgers or whoever does a Miyazaki tribute, they look at films like this and pick the highlights.
Yeah,
and
well, it was, as I said coming in, these are so many moments
stickers,
that I knew.
The GIFs.
So it's the GIFs. It's, as you said, the Gifiotech.
The Gifiotech. Well, let's have our Gifiotech moment right here. Calcifer being used as a hob, where Howl is making bacon and eggs. It's the most simple meal, but it looks the most delicious meal I've ever seen. And he's cracking the eggs and throwing the shells into Calcifer's mouth. Just an incredible little moment. Also, the character we've not mentioned, Turnip Head, who just shows up out of nowhere. He's sort of a scarecrow figure that bounces along, turns up at one point with an umbrella. Again, a key Miyazaki thing, people turning it with umbrellas. But also, he's key to the plot at the end.
Yeah.
One of those classic, like with Spirited Away, Miyazaki plots that can be resolved with one line of dialogue.
Yeah.
Which, well, the less said about that, the better. But then also, this, we talked before about Miyazaki cats, the cat bus, Whisper of the Heart. This has a Miyazaki dog. There are not many Miyazaki dogs out there, but Heen, who is this, what would you call him? He's a long-haired, almost a schnauzer, I guess.
And he's got spaniel-like
Spaniel schnauzer type guy with a little squeak as instead of a bark. One of the best little Miyazaki creations, I think. There are many of these moments throughout this film, and that's what I come back for. So even if I seem negative about the plot, the story, the themes, it's all these jukebox moments.
I feel like you are repeating exactly what I said at the end of our Spirited Away episode when we revisit this film.
But
this is what we're going to come back to,
is
the moments.
It's the moments, and maybe that will come to define this later period of Miyazaki.
Mm.
Or this is probably a good way we're going, darting back and forth throughout his history.
Yeah, but I think it's important now. As we've hit our second series and we jump into a new batch of films, let's start ranking them. Let's put Michael Leder's films on the leaderboard. This is when I make Michael rank these films. At the end of our first series, the current leaderboard was in sixth position and breaking my heart every time I see it. Only yesterday. In fifth, Spirited Away. Princess Mononoke in fourth, Grave of the Fireflies in third, My Neighbor Totoro in second, and number one, Whisper of the Heart. Where is Howl's Moving Castle going to go in this? I'm going to place a bet and say it's going to go below Spirited Away and above Only Yesterday.
Oh, Jake, you've just lost all your money. I feel like I should always say that this is gradations within gradations. That, you know, these films, just because wherever this is landing doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad film or that it's awful, but this is probably bottom of the table for me. And but you should be happy about
I'm,
that.
I'm glad only yesterday is no longer the footer.
And because it did break my heart to sit here in front of you and our guest Robbie Collin that week and say, sorry, your favourite film is my least favourite so far. But no, I'd say that Howl's Moving Castle, whilst it is momentarily fantastic overall, it's number 7 so far in the leaderboard.
Wow, we've made a bad start to this new series, haven't we?
But it's a big one. This is the thing. It's one that everyone has seen. Behind Spirited Away or Totoro, this is one of the big ones. And we have quite a mini season ahead of us, don't we?
We certainly do. And that will carry on next week. We hope you've enjoyed your time in the Ghibliotech. The next episode we're going to do is going to be on Pom Poko, which for one reason or another, I've heard quite a bit about.
Yes, exactly. This one
quite
has
big things.
Big round things, dangly things. So Pom Poko, last season, our second episode was Grave of the Fireflies, Isao Takahata's resounding classic, one of the greatest films ever made. And we're going to do the same thing, but it's more of a left turn than then. This is Pom Poko, which is a magical tanuki gentrification testicular fantasy film. Does
another
that sound about
one.
Right? Yeah, one of those ones, right? Yeah. When will they stop making those?
Yeah.
Well, Jake, I can't wait to see what you make of this one. This is by far the weirdest one. We had a lot of tweets and feedback saying, when are you going to get to Pom Poko? And we're going to see that next week.
Excellent. I can't wait.
And finally, big thanks to Silk Factory for the help making this new series. We're recording today in their studio in sunny Soho in London.
And they don't just make podcasts. They're a full-blown film marketing creative agency, and they also make trailers and content for TV, digital, social platforms.
Go and check out their work at thesilkfactory.co.
And that really wraps things up. Until then, you can follow Michael on Twitter at Michael J. Leader.
And follow Jake on Twitter at Jake H. Cunningham.
Ghibliotech is a Little Dot Studios production. We record at Silk Factory. Our music is made by Anthony Ng, our artwork is by Sophie Moe, and Steph Watts helps us out with all of our GIFs, images, and anything else we post online. The show is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Steph Watts, and Harold McShiel. That's me. I do the voiceover for the credits as well.
Hi folks, thanks for sticking with us through the credits. We like to reward listeners with a bit of extra trivia at the end. So this one's a bit of an audience participation one. About 20 minutes into Howl's Moving Castle, you see a boy running down the street outside the Great Wizard Jenkins' shopfront. And he looks remarkably like Pazu, the main character from Miyazaki's Castle in the Sky. I've never been sure if that is him. It looks remarkably like him. Let me know what you think. But there is a connection between Howl's Moving Castle and Castle in the Sky. Howl's is set partly in Wales, as is the book that it's based on. And Castle in the Sky was inspired both by the landscape of Wales and the 1980s miners' strikes. So there is a connection between the two films. Maybe there's a link there. Let us know what you think.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.